Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 39, titled Relative and Absolute, A Conversation Between Manjushri and Vimalakirti, Part 2.
Anyway, even can emptiness be conceptually constructed? Even that concept is itself emptiness, empty, and emptiness cannot construct emptiness. Maybe it doesn't need to construct emptiness. You know, I translated this. This is considered a big challenge to translate these dialogues. Huge challenge. When the Chinese translator of the second version of the Vimalakirti to be translated to Chinese, Sun Jiao, when he read this dialogue and whatever, however much he understood it himself, he flipped out because to him this was better than Zhuangzi and Lao Tzu. He was a Taoist school teacher and literata before that. So where should emptiness be sought? Manjushri, emptiness should be sought among the 62 convictions. Remember in the Dharmajala Sutta that you read, in the Pali, you had the 62 false views or false convictions. But in the Mahayana, they don't say false, they just say conviction, because any absolutistic conviction is a mistake. It's false, in other words. Any kind of thing that's absolutized by a relative being is an exaggeration. And a relative conviction, it would be fine. But usually convictions are not. Where should the 62 convictions be sought? They should be sought in the liberation of the Buddhas, Tathagata. He goes on. Where should the liberation of the Buddhas be sought? They should be sought in the prime mental activities of all the beings. That's a really challenging one. What does that mean? That, in other words, we're supposed to be all ignorant. How come our prime mental activity is where the liberation of the Buddhas is? How come that is? And then this relates to a Buddhist epistemological thing that was developed a bit later, maybe, than by philosophers who write treatises, not in the sutras, but the idea is here in the sutras, which is that the basic sense experience, before it is mixed with a concept and cognitively recognized, is something that is just touches the relative reality of things, but it sort of eludes concepts. It's a very neat idea. In other words, it's like there are two experiences. When I look at that wall, which I guess, what do we call it, beige? Is it off-white or beige? What will we call it? Not where the things are, the sound apples are hanging, but the wall itself is painted beige, I guess. Is that satisfactory to everyone? So I see the beige wall. But when I first look at it and see beige, I don't necessarily have the word beige for it. At a certain point, my concept pops in there, and then I see, quote, beige, unquote. You follow me? Those are two different experiences. Where you see beige, and then there's like a split second where you have to then recognize beige. Right? Quote beige, unquote. So they make a difference between seeing blue and seeing quote blue, unquote. Right? You get that? But our conceptualizing is so fast that I think I see quote blue, unquote, automatically. And when I think I see quote blue, unquote, right off, I think it's really blue, unquote, blue. Intrinsically really blue. And there's a massive facticity of its blueness that my mind and my adds to it, if you follow me. But my prime mental activity is just looking up and without deciding what I'm seeing. In a way, you have that moment where you don't know what you're looking at. But we rarely have that moment. Actually, when we do, sometimes it's associated with aesthetic pleasure. Sometimes, non-figurative art, abstract art like Kandinsky or something, or some of, not Picasso, the distorted art, some of those people who did things with pure color, you know? It's like, what is that, you know? It's just like abstract. It's like swirling clouds of color or something. And that's considered to give pleasure because you're not right away seeing there's a church and a steeple and thing. And Van Gogh was moving in that when he drew the crows, you know, in the summer in Provence, you know, swirling sunlight and haystacks or whatever that was in that field. Remember the famous thing with the same black thing swirling there, the crows. because he was stoned on turpentine from his paint, you know, like a little bit and drinking too much absinthe and so on. He was a little bit wigged out. So he wasn't seeing what it is. He was just getting the swirl of the color in the thing. So, and then sometimes you hear music or something, you have an expression, I was carried away. Meaning I wasn't thinking, okay, now Mozart is doing D flat and a chord there, and he's like doing a modular change for the other, and your concepts are not recognizing it. But it's just sort of penetrating your senses and stirring your emotions in a certain way without you labeling it a bunch of ways. Right? When you go to museums, what do people do in museums? They go, they look at something, but then you notice if you watch them, then they immediately go down and look at the label. Who paid that? Where is it? How much is it worth? Like, what is it? Oh, France, yes. Oh, Impressionists, yes. Now I know. Okay, then cool. But then they're bored and they go to the next one. So the prime mental activity of all beings, the theory is that true sense perception, or what Kant might have called sense intuition, meaning unmediated by a concept, experience, it is intellectual intuition and sense intuition, which the Buddhists preceded that by about 1,200 years, that idea, what they call pratyaksha. And they argued against Indian epistemologists, who, you know, Hindu ones, who didn't agree with them, who think that the concept is right there in the thing, because they don't like that idea. They didn't like that idea of intrinsic realitylessness or emptiness. They were resisting that always. They were thinking that there's some essential thing, like Plato, like other metaphysicians. There's an essence in things that really makes them what they are, rather than it's all conventionally constructed, you know, by one's experience, and that the subject and object are always interwoven relativistically, which was from the beginning the movement within Buddhism. So that's kind of a wonderful thing. So that means, like, your senses are enlightened already, even though your mind is very puzzled. It's kind of the idea of prime mental enlightenment of the Buddhas, the Tathagatas, the realized ones, is it sought in the prime mental activity of all beings. Yes?
So there's like that raw consciousness without labels, that, you know, if you think of a newborn child with no concept of words or ideas yet, and they're just born in the delivery room, but how is that?
It's nothing to do with baby in the living room, really, necessarily.
But to take that, but they have no idea to take.
Well, not from Buddhist point of view. Baby in the living room, has ideas actually. They can't articulate them yet because their equipment is not. But they come from previous life with the instincts, what's called verbalizing instincts. Why they can learn so quickly. That's why they know how to suck right away. They're like really, they're really quick. They go after the titty really quickly. And Buddhists believe that. So they don't agree that they're this tabula rasa idea. They don't agree with that. So it's, you know, normally, in our normal experience, unless we have learned through mindfulness practice how our mind, more observed how our mind works, we think that our concepts are natural. Like, I do think, you know, our habitual thing is the table. Well, yeah, that table has its own table essence, and I react to it. And we don't realize that the mind is immediately putting a concept on it very fast. And therefore, many philosophers argued against this kind of epistemology. I don't want to go too much into that at this stage. I'm just commenting on that. Where should the liberation of Tathagata be sought? Sought in the prime mental activity of all beings. But what is nice about it, in a way, it is that, and this relates to the chapter 9, which I will try to get to, which is also in the Prajnaparamita style, where we're dealing with non-duality, which is the ultimate thing of this. So anyway, he goes on with that. And then there's this on page 45. I just want to point out to you. He says the way to console the bodhisattva about their sickness is, he says, a sick bodhisattva should control his own. Well, first he says the way you should console a bodhisattva, another bodhisattva, is to tell him all these things, you know, on page 44, in such a way to make him happy by all of the things he seeks, you know, by being sort of accepting, resigned to his thing, not overdoing it, realizing this is the nature of life, encourage his consciousness of working for the welfare of beings, not to be overly distressed, to maintain the primal pure lack of craving, become a king of healers who can cure all sicknesses. Thus, he should try to make him happy. But then he says, but how should a sick bodhisattva control his own mind? And at that Vimalakirti says, control his own mind with the following consideration. Sickness arises from total involvement in the process of misunderstanding from beginningless time. It arises from the passions that result from unreal mental constructions, and hence ultimately nothing is perceived which can be said to be sick. So there you do, he says, really free yourself from suffering when you're sick is to look at your true nature, and your sickness dissolves under analysis yourself. And here he does it. Why? The body is the issue of the four main elements, earth, water, wind, fire. And in these elements, there's no owner and no agent. There is no self in this body. And except for art, that means no intrinsic reality or essence or intrinsic objectivity or identity. And except for arbitrary insistence on self, ultimately no I, which can be said to be sick, can be apprehended. Therefore, thinking I should not adhere to any self, and I should rest in the knowledge of the root of illness, he should abandon the conception of himself as a personality and produce the conception of himself as a thing. And this word thing could also be translated event or process, but thing is the simplest way of translating it. Thinking, this body is an aggregate of many things. When it is born, only things are born. When it ceases, only things cease. These things have no awareness or feeling of each other. When they are born, they do not think I am born. When they cease, they do not think I cease. So there, that's a sort of brief summary of what is called the realization of personal selflessness. Or subjectivity selflessness, the selflessness of the subject. Meaning that when you look at yourself as a subjectivity, you cannot find an unchanging thing. And that feeling that, like right now I have, I mean, I don't pretend not to be ignorant myself. I have right now a feeling that the Bob Thurman subjectivity sort of point of perception that experiences standing here in this classroom is the same thing that was this morning in another classroom, that a year ago was in another one, but 20 years ago was somewhere else, and that's never changed. And there's this me looking out there that somehow, I don't really know what it is, but I just feel it's the same thing. And I get, if I ever have a moment of slippage, you know, I get nervous. I think I'm old now, or maybe I'm becoming demented. I don't know what I am. So we feel that's normal, in other words. That you know, you were in wherever you were, you took a boat, a plane, or whatever, came to New York, you're here at Columbia classroom, and there's that one same thing, which is your subjective point of awareness. You feel you have, right? You do. But if you turn to look at that, where is that? And you know, right away you know from modern anatomy, there is no such thing. There's no point in your brain that is like the you point. You know, that's like the ultimate, like, hard disk or something, the CPU that doesn't change, you know. There's just, you know, endless space of storage space, you know, in the frontal lobe, you know, and there's the limbic brain that wants to be a crocodile, and there's, like, whatever it is. And there's no one thing. Absolutely not. And from materially speaking, and then you'll think, well, mentally there must be. Or maybe it's my soul, or whatever. In the old days, people had images of the little homunculus, little Jesus Christ in there, a little Vishnu, a Krishna in there, a little Buddha in there. They had these kind of things. But nowadays, and then atoms and subatomic and wave-particle paradox, I mean, we are lost today, nowadays. And yet, we still feel there's one unchanging point in my field. That's me. That's me. That's my subjectivity. But if I really look hard, I will have an experience like this, where I will not find it, and then I have to be careful. Someone might warn me. Oh, if you do that, you'll become a basket case. You won't know. Early on, people referred to it in the translation of these things. Maybe only 30, 40 years ago, people would say egolessness, but they would pick on ego. And ego is just a Greek pronoun anyway. It's not a technical term, really. It's just I in Greece. If you want yogurt, you say ego wants yogurt, and nobody thinks you're being egotistical, because ego is the first person pronoun in Greek, naturally. And actually, when Freud wrote his book, he didn't write ego; he wrote ich, the ich. You know, in German, the I is ich, but in English, ich is ich. Nobody wanted to use I. So then the English translator, British translator of Freud, put ego, which is he just picked the Greek I, you know, but it's just a pronoun. So they'll even think that's scary to have a realization of personal selflessness because it will somehow mean like I don't exist. Oh, there's no me here, and that's not what is discovered. What's discovered is that there's a changing relational personality, which is constructed by education, by experience, by this and that, and which changes all the time. And that's considered a very deep insight, but it's still a superficial one. The next one is deeper. Furthermore, he should consider, understand thoroughly the conception of himself as a thing by cultivating the following consideration. Just as in the case of the conception of self, so the conception of thing is also a misunderstanding, and this misunderstanding is also a grave sickness. I should free myself from this sickness and should strive to abandon it. What is the elimination of this sickness? It is the elimination of egoism and possessiveness. He takes it in that direction. But really, it's like we already did with the thought experiment about the nose. Because the nose, in a way, is the thing, right? But then if you really look for nose, you can't find it in that realistic way of really being there. Every point on your nose, if you had a computer, like I think that plastic surgeons do nowadays, they show you like a computerized sort of scan of your face, and then they show how they're going to reshape it this way and that way. You know, you see it in advertisements. Now, I never had the pleasure of being in an office, but they show it in advertisements. But then the whole grid they show on the nose, all of those points, none of them are the nose, because they're to be an exact point. They are not even there. A point is not there. A point has no size, so it can't be anywhere, technically speaking, even though the only way it can be exactly there is to have no size. Fun, isn't it? But we assume all the point is there, yeah. We assume, but actually, it's just a dot that's there, which is not a point, if we see something there. So, point is, that we already did, that's the overcoming of the conception of a thing as having intrinsic thingness. And then he goes on anyway, but then and then once we think that things have intrinsic thingness, we think, my thing, my sweater, you know, my hand, my fingertip, you know, my knuckle. And we get egoistic and possessive about that thing. It begins to have, you know, there's a thought experiment you can do where you go and look at something in a store and you see it a certain way. Then you buy it and then you see it and you add to seeing that same object, the shoe or the whatever it is, it has like yourness about it because of your possession. Because it's your object that you own. And it's different, it becomes different because you invest something different on it. So that's why he takes it in that direction. And it is the freedom from dualism. What is the freedom from dualism? It is the absence of involvement with either the external or the internal. In other words, making the object some sort of real thing that has its interiority and its exteriority. What is the absence of involvement with either internal or external? Internal, it is non-deviation, non-fluctuation, non-distraction from equanimity, all things being equal. What is equanimity? It's the quality of everything from self to liberation. Why? Relative self, that is, which exists. Absolute self doesn't, but relative self does. And liberation, absolute liberation, in a way, doesn't exist, but relative liberation does. Why? Because both self and liberation are void or empty. How can both be void? As verbal designations, they are void and neither is established in reality. That is to say, they're void of intrinsic reality, they're void of intrinsic substantiality, they're void of intrinsic objectivity, they're void of intrinsic identity. All of those levels of excessive, exaggerated reality they lack. Therefore, one who sees such a quality makes no difference between sickness and voidness. His sickness is itself voidness, and that sickness as voidness is itself void. So he's trying to cheer. This is how you cheer up a bodhisattva. There you do. And but what is so then he says, what is the thorough understanding of the basic apparent object? Okay, that's the table. It is its non-perception, as no objects exist ultimately. What is non-perception? The internal subject and the external object are not perceived dualistically. Therefore, it is called non-perception. In a way, the baby, however, on a superficial level, non-instinctual level, does have this, what you did bring up intelligently, in the sense that, you know, they say like a baby doesn't know the difference between itself and the mother's breast or something that is, you know, it doesn't make a distinction, although maybe it does a little bit, subtly speaking. But certainly, functionally, it doesn't really know the difference. It doesn't differentiate itself from its environment. And that's why we're so vulnerable as children. And then it goes on like that. So then I want to jump, though, in the last minute, to the non-duality one, since that's been mentioned. And the non-duality is this very challenging Mahayana thing that I outlined before, where the only place left for the ultimate is the relativity of the relative, you could say. But in a way, that doesn't mean that in a relative sense there isn't such a thing as the ultimate or the absolute. Because we have a habit of thinking of things as absolute. And we even have a craving for that because of our wish for security. So for example, when we were snails and we were in our shell in the countryside in the south of France, and we poked our little antenna out and looked around with our little bug eyes, we wanted to know absolutely for sure that there was no Frenchman out there with a fork before we were going to go crawling out of our bush or wherever we were, you know. So the sort of animal that defines itself as something inside its boundary has a wish for security about its environment of knowing absolutely, like really, really, not just sort of relatively really, but really, really where it is. Although, of course, absolutely really, nobody's thinking philosophically that you can't know absolutely anything because you only know relatively things. So therefore, there is this sort of wish for the absolute. And what emptiness is, therefore, and why negation becomes so important in the epistemology of this philosophical and scientific tradition, is that all absolutes have been chased down, so to speak. And on the one you could sort of say in a experiential way, but actually from the beginning in a logical way in regard to the binarity of language, you know, the yes, no, you know, the zero or one of the computer, you know, there's two options. In the case of binarity, you know, we've only experienced relative things because experience itself is a relational process. So, but because we're clever, we can think of something opposite of that. And we can hope to experience something that is non-relative. That would be maybe the final experience or something like that. And then we develop, but obviously, like, this is not an absolute blackboard because I can write on it, so it's relative. The atoms in it are not absolute because they can constitute a blackboard. And the subatomic particles or the waves or whatever they are, ultimately, they're all relative because they're making a thing that can relate to as a blackboard. So, but there must be something absolute. So then, looking for God, looking for some sort of atomic substance that is irreducible, material people, or even looking for nothingness, for say some existentialist. These must be the absolute thing. But what emptiness means is that all those absolute things are unfindable by the kind of mental energy of the being that wants to find an absolute, that wants to really know for sure and with a sort of absolute security. That being cannot find any such thing at all. And so what emptiness is describes what that experience is really, a negational experience. It's like when you look, if you're looking for an elephant in this room, you have to have a notion of what an elephant is, first of all, to look for an elephant. Okay? You have a notion of there's such a thing as an elephant. Then you look everywhere where there could be an elephant. And then you finally give up. There could be a mini elephant, a micro elephant. Somebody could have an elephant bracelet on. They could have an elephant tattoo on their back or something that you can't see. I mean, there could be some form of elephant somewhere. There could be an elephant ghost in the room. But you can't find it. So in a way, it's inconclusive. A negational cognition is inconclusive. You draw a line arbitrarily and you give up looking. And you might even say, but you don't ever find a non-elephant. Right? So but that openness then to not finding the thing that you're looking for, which in this case is whatever your concept of an absolute is called emptiness. And then they say that emptiness is also empty. Meaning, that's what you come up with when you're looking for some non-empty thing. But when you look for that itself, emptiness, as again something you can relate to and you can be sure about, it will also be empty. You can't find emptiness either, if you follow. And what that keeps doing, as it empties you out of your habit, or you look inside for the self, and you don't find anything that you can absolutely say, that's me. There's no barcode, there's no code, there's no homunculus, there's no gene that's unchanging, there's no absolute entity in there. Then you... The fact of your relationality is what you end up with. Because you are looking. For example, Descartes was right. He couldn't find himself, but he was looking. But then he thought his looking entity was an absolute. But it isn't. It's only an absolutely relative thing, if you use absolutely in that sense, of conclusively. And the absoluteness of it, he cannot relate to, because that you can't relate to the absolute, except by a negation. But then negation opens you to, in a way, the affirmation of relationality. That's all it does. So non-duality, that means, so actually, though, the release of that negation or cognition, if you're looking for suffering, for example, real suffering, and then you can't find it when it also dissolves under analysis. There's a sense of release about it. And apparently, when you get that sense of release, then you can enjoy relationality in a way where it is never suffering. And that's non-dual. That's the non-dualistic experience of the relative world. Of absolute relativity, you could say, even though that's a contradiction in terms, but it just means that you haven't found any absolute outside of the relativity that is relevant to the relativity, except its absence, something like that. However, language is inherently dualistic, and therefore language has difficulty expressing that kind of thing. And there's something about it that has to go beyond language, but it's not necessarily an irrational leap. Sometimes this juncture is expressed as a kind of irrational leap. But that would be denied by these people. And so the Dharma Door of Non-Duality in chapter 9, which takes this to the deep thing, and there are 32 bodhisattvas. And they all say things like, I and mine are two. If there's no presumption of a self, there'll be no possessiveness. Thus the absence of presumption is the entrance into non-duality. Another one says, grasping and non-grasping are two. What is not grasped is not perceived. What is not perceived is neither presumed nor repudiated. Thus, the inaction and non-involvement of all things is the entrance into non-duality. And it goes on like that. Even they say nirvana and samsara, life and liberation, are dualistic. Having seen the nature of life, one neither belongs to it nor is one utterly liberated from it. Such understanding is an entrance into non-duality, meaning that such understanding of life is liberation in life, is what it's saying. And going on like that. Then finally, Manjushri says, well, you guys said something really great, all of you. Good sirs, you have all spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know no one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing, that is the entrance into non-duality. So it's just total straight man here, he's functioning. And then Manjushri says to Vimalakirti, we have all given our own teachings, noble sir. Now may you elucidate the teaching of the entrance into the principle of non-duality. And thereupon the Jami Vimalakirti kept his silence, saying nothing at all. So this is a famous thing. It's called the lion's roar of the silence of Vimalakirti, because it is a silence in a certain context. The context is where people are seeking a formulation of the ultimate or absolute nature of reality. And what the silence says in that context is that you don't need to be told, because the primary mental activity of all beings is the same as the liberation of the Buddha. So a level of your being knows it, actually, he's trying to say. He said, the silence is kind of confirming in people, and they say, Well, first, Crown Prince Manjushri applauded Vimalakirti. He said, excellent, excellent, noble sir. This is indeed the entrance into the non-duality of the Bodhisattvas. Here there is no use for syllables, sounds, and ideas. And when these teachings have been declared, 5,000 Bodhisattvas entered the door of the Dharma of non-duality and attained the tolerance of the birthlessness of things, which is a level of enlightenment, where you tolerate that things are unborn. And meaning something like this. Okay, we did a thought experiment very, very cursorily, because you sort of followed what I was saying, looking dubious about not being able to find your own nose, right? Which brought it very much home to everybody, I hope. Since everybody has a nose here. But if you did that very sustainably with very strong concentration over a period of time, and you really realize that you're surrounded by things, that you are there when you don't probe too much about how they're there, and then when you do probe, they will disappear under analysis. You know, whether or not they actually, you see through them, like Superman, is not the point. The point is you realize that, you know, it's with some machine, and you have actually the benefit, actually, of modern technology of investigation, microscopes, electron microscopes, electron accelerators, etc. Telescopes, you have the benefit of all these kind of technologies, which you have heard the report of what the results of those things are. Of course, they're not attached to your brain, but they're attached to your mind, your memory, by report. And so you realize that that's probably real and that you can't find any of these things. Although there are a few people in the physics world who still promise that after the Higgs boson, they're going to come up with something else, and then finally everyone will be secure because there'll be a real thing you can hold on to. Because that's really threatening to people who want to have something to hold on to. But anyway, you have a lot. So imagine that you did that. Then you never will perceive your non-knows. That you don't see. But if you try to find your real nose a lot of times, you might sort of get to where you know that when you do perceive your nose, you kind of perceive it in a lighter way because you know at the same moment that it's not your nose, whatever you're perceiving. Do you follow? It's like, and don't look so baffled, you look in the mirror and you see a three-dimensional thing in the mirror and you know without thinking that you're just seeing a reflection. You know that. Your mind corrects the impression that your optic nerves deliver that there's a room inside the mirror. The sort of opposite room to this one. Unless you're Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland or somebody and you step through it. And to Narnia, whatever, all those different kids' things that they do. But otherwise, you know that, right? So you develop that feeling of the non-existence, the birthlessness of things. But they're non-produced in the ultimate sense. And when you do that, it becomes like the mirror surface that you know intuitively from experience. It isn't something that you saw because you never see. You don't see the mirror surface blank of all reflections. You can't, there's no way. It's just the fact that you know. So you have a double cognition, actually. And your double cognition is seeing the reflection and knowing that it's, and correcting it right away, and so knowing that it doesn't exist the way it appears. You follow me? And yet you can see the details in the reflection. But you see it in a lighter way. You don't see it as a three-dimensional volume thing, or you don't assume that three-dimensional volumicity, massive facticity of the room as a three-dimensional space, you don't need that. And your mind corrects for the perception of it, where you practically don't, you sort of act as if almost you don't see it. You're just seeing a reflection, right? So what non-duality Vimalakirti is saying is that we all know at some deep level, which is non-conceptual and experiential, that everything we grasp onto is illusory in the sense that it isn't really what it seems to be. And this accounts for certain anxiety and insecurity. And it accounts for the many philosophies and things that say, well, everything I am experiencing and me and the world around me is like a really unsure and insecure place. But then God is secure, or nothingness is secure. The materialists, they really think real nothingness is there. They definitely do. They think so. They're going to jump into it when they die. And they get upset if you challenge it, and they'll fight for it like somebody would fight for that I'm going to go in the lap of God, some absolute thing that has nothing to do with the world, but somehow is the essence of it all. Which, of course, is completely irrational, but I'm insisting on it. It's also irrational that nothing is going to embrace me in my consciousness, which has never known anything other than continuity. I thought maybe I had moments of unconsciousness when I fell asleep, but I never even experienced any of them. Because isn't that's annoying part about falling asleep? You have to wake up right away. There's no sense of time of being unconscious. That's very annoying. I always want to stay unconscious. And I'm really tired. But you don't, you just have a threshold, and then you're waking up. And it's, you have to go to class, or you have to do whatever you have to do. So this is what Vimalakirti is affirming in people, and it's very similar. In Hinduism, there's a famous thing where the guru tells the disciple, who has to be a Brahmin, and the guru has to be a Brahmin, and they say, Tattvam Asi, you are God, you are that. And even the disciples can sometimes say themselves, based on the scripture, Aham Brahma Asmi, I am God, Brahma they call. And then supposedly if you hear that in a deeply faithful way, then you feel you are whatever you imagine God might be, some sort of absolute freedom entity. But the Buddhist thing is, if this is nirvana, and therefore you actually are more really in nirvana than you are in this illusory world of individuation and self and other and suffering, then you should know that yourself without being told. And your lower, and your mind beneath, let's say, your cellular mind, your subatomic mind, beneath the level of your constructed concepts, knows where it is. And you don't need to be told where you are. It's a kind of idea like that. But the first level of entering that is rather a kind of tolerance. Why is it called tolerance, that level of cognition? Because if everything is non-existent, if we are experiencing existence in the mirror surface of its non-existence, that makes us feel frightened. I don't want to not know what this really is. I want to know what it really is. So I will go the right direction, et cetera, do what I want, get where I want to go, thinking that it's going to be some sort of big satisfaction when I get there. So the idea that it all is somehow ultimately non-existent in the way that I experience it, it's something that at first I have to learn to tolerate and then kind of cope with that. It's a little bit like a surfer, which I cannot do because I was failed to be born in California. But that's my ambition for my future life, having been born in Manhattan, where we don't surf. We would be surfing sewage, I think, too much. And a surfer has to have a tolerance of not being able to hold on to anything in that wave, but somehow find a balance just sort of fitting in. And this very powerful thing that could smash his head on the gravel or on the sand. And then they can sail along the surface of that. They have a tolerance in the ungraspability of the wave. If a surfer tries to hold on to something in the wave, they're going to take a couple. Take it, have a nice weekend.